Peter Miller is president of Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights. He's also on the steering committee of the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. It's a national coalition of over 320 organizations nationwide. He's traveled to Israel and Palestine, met with Palestinian and Israeli human rights activists, and witnessed firsthand the closures, checkpoints, settlements, and the building of Israel's new system of walls and fences on Palestinian lands. He's a native here from Oregon and received a bachelor's in psychology from Reed College in 1992. Welcome, Peter Miller.
We're gathered here tonight because of the terrible siege of Gaza that is happening to the people of Gaza, and made even worse by the attack in January and December of last year on Gaza, that's made a society that's already been suffering from a crushing siege, acknowledged by many in the international community to be a war crime itself, a violation of the Geneva Conventions, and has attacked this people, ravaged its infrastructure, including the civilian infrastructure. And people report, for instance, Cindy Corey went to Gaza sometimes in April, 4 months later came back to see Gaza, and she said the remarkable thing about Gaza was that nothing has changed. The rubble's still in the streets. There's no water. All the rebuilding that you might expect after a war, in a normal war, has not occurred. Gaza is still in a state of rubble after a war and still under siege. Israel's attack came after a time when it had negotiated a ceasefire with Hamas to end the rocket fire that Hamas was engaged in, not only Hamas, but some other militant groups that Hamas doesn't necessarily have control over. And down the last month before hostilities started to resume, Hamas had managed to get the rocket fire back to Israel almost to zero. But Israel had a part of the bargain, was it was going to relieve the siege of Gaza, and it did not do so. And then it launched some initial attacks, incursions. Hamas decided that the ceasefire was meaningless and began its rocket fire. In the meantime, Israel had planned this attack for 6 months. So it wasn't like they suddenly decided, oh, we need to do something. It was an intentional, planned attack, not a war of necessity, because they could have renegotiated a ceasefire. And they did it conveniently at the end of the Bush administration, and stopped just prior to Obama's inauguration. Now, many of us knew, seeing the terrible images, firsthand reports from people in Gaza, the Norwegian doctor who was in the hospital reporting the pictures, all of these things, just knew that war crimes were being committed. It was pretty obvious that Israel was exceeding any kind of normal military attack, because there was no effort whatsoever to protect any civilians, and no effort, and a lot of effort expended in destroying civilian infrastructure. And so we all knew that there were war crimes being committed. And afterwards, more stories came out. Israeli soldiers who had taken part and were disturbed by what they were asked to do, testimony started to come out of Gaza of what they had done, and people felt that the military necessity was not there. And then the story came out about an Israeli rabbi who was attached to the military who was handing out literature to the soldiers going into Gaza, basically telling them to show no mercy. And then another story in the Israeli newspaper about an Israeli soldier who had a T-shirt designed. And the T-shirt design depicted a pregnant Palestinian woman with a gun sight on her belly, and it said, one shot, two kills. And I think all of these things started to shock the conscience, really, of people all around the world. And the United Nations now has responded to these charges. It instituted a mission to investigate possible war crimes in Gaza. And they chose Robert Goldstone, a South African judge who has just absolutely impeccable credentials. He helped fight apartheid in South Africa. He was part of the South African judicial system. He investigated war crimes in Bosnia, Kosovo, and Rwanda. So he's been asked by the UN to carry on various investigatory tasks. And he himself is Jewish and considers himself a supporter of Israel. He was reluctant to take on this task, and yet he said, you know, you can't just investigate Israel, you have to also investigate what Hamas has done. And they agreed, and based on that, he agreed to carry on this mission. And in an interview with Bill Moyers, Mr. Goldstone rejected the notion from right-wing Jews that he was betraying his people, saying of the charge, it's a form of racism. Why should my being Jewish stop me from investigating Israel? I just don't see it. I think a friend should be open to criticism from friends. I think it's more important. I think true friends criticize friends when they do wrong things. Bill Moyers asked Mr. Goldstone what he saw in Gaza, and he said, well, I saw the destruction of the only flour-producing factory in Gaza. I saw fields plowed up by Israeli tank bulldozers. I saw chicken farms for egg production completely destroyed, tens of thousands of chickens killed. I met with families who lost their loved ones in homes in which they were seeking shelter from the Israeli ground forces. I had to have the very emotional and difficult interviews with fathers whose little daughters were killed, whose families were killed. One family, over 21 members, killed by Israeli mortars. So it was a very difficult investigation, which will give me nightmares for the rest of my life. The resulting report's over 500 pages long, and it's critical of both Israel and Hamas, but the vast majority of the report deals with what Israel has done, because it committed by far the largest portion of the crimes. And the Israeli government has absolutely refused to assist with the report. They refused to provide witnesses, they refused access, they did not allow the fact-finding mission into Israel itself. So they had to get testimony, when they did get testimony from Israelis, by going to another country and inviting them to come to another country. And they did get some testimony from Israelis that way. And this report's a valuable resource for all of us because it is so detailed and comprehensive. For instance, I've just written a summary of the report's implications to Caterpillar Bulldozer, because Caterpillar is the bulldozers it sells to Israel are used for these military purposes. They're armored, and there's a boycott. We're trying to institute a boycott on Caterpillar products. And this report references these bulldozers 25 different times, and it's clear that Caterpillar bulldozers have been used to commit serious war crimes. I'll mention one of them. He interviewed two Palestinians in Gaza who informed the mission that they had watched Israeli armored bulldozers systematically destroy land, crops, chickens, and farm infrastructure. He stated he watched the bulldozers plow through fields with crops and trees, destroying everything in their path. He watched as the armored bulldozers destroyed the chicken farms, crushing the wire mesh coops with chickens inside. He noted that the drivers of the tanks would spend hours flattening the chicken coops, sometimes stopping for coffee breaks before resuming their work. Among the more major findings is that they said that the operation, the military operation by Israel, fits into a continuum of policies aimed at pursuing Israel's political objectives with regards to Gaza and the occupied territories in general. Many such policies are based on or result in violations of international human rights and humanitarian law. Military objectives, as stated by the government of Israel, do not explain the facts as ascertained by the mission, nor are they congruous with the patterns identified by the mission during the investigation. Another important conclusion of the report is the mission further considers that the series of acts that deprive Palestinians in the Gaza Strip of their means of subsistence, employment, housing, and water, that deny their freedom of movement and their right to leave and enter their own country, that limit their rights to access the court of law and an effective remedy, could lead a competent court to find that the crime of persecution, a crime against humanity, has been committed. And one of the more important findings, and one that probably explains why Israel and its friends are fighting this report and trying to bury it so significantly, is that the key finding is that this military action was planned at the highest levels, and therefore the responsibility is not the responsibility of the individual soldier necessarily carrying it out. It was all the generals and the government that was involved up to the hilt. He said, whatever violations of international humanitarian and human rights law have been committed, the systematic and deliberate nature of the activities described in this report leave the mission in no doubt that responsibility lies in the first place with those who designed, planned, ordered, and oversaw the operation. And this is why it's so important for what we're trying to do tonight and people around the world are doing, because international law has worked, but all the governments upholding the international law is not working. The United States, for instance, the House of Representatives just passed House Resolution 867, which condemned the Goldstone Report and said that Obama should absolutely ignore anything having to do with the Goldstone Report, should completely ignore it. And Mr. Goldstone himself fought back against that. He wrote a letter to the Congress people who sponsored this bill, and point by point, Mr. Goldstone refuted the bill that they were about to pass. At the end, he concluded, "The allegation that Hamas was able to shape the findings of my report or that it pre-screened the witnesses is devoid of the truth. I challenge anyone to produce evidence in support of it." Unfortunately, it passed in the House, as we might expect. Our own congressman here, Earl Blumenauer, fortunately voted against it. David Wu and Peter DeFazio voted present, which is sort of a soft no, you know. We could have done better in that regard. And unfortunately, Kurt Schrader and Greg Walden voted for it. So I would contact those two if you are in contact with them. And I should mention that Washington Representative Brian Baird, who's been to Gaza, not only voted against the bill, but he wrote a very powerful statement why the bill was so wrong and why the Goldstone Report needed to be heard. Now, when governments, you know, fail to uphold our principles and fail to even uphold their own principles, I mean, international law is a part of what these governments have all agreed to, and yet the United States in particular, alongside Israel, absolutely refused to hold people to account, especially Israel, when these kinds of things come to light. And so it's up to people like us, people with good conscience, to be that conscience. And that is why we're here tonight. We're sending, basically, in sending these students, we're sending emissaries of the people to Gaza who are acting as our witnesses and our siege breakers. And I wanted to close with just one final quote from the Goldstone Report. "Finally, the mission wishes to thank the people of Gaza for their warm welcome, their humanity, and their hospitality in spite of such difficult and painful circumstances." Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Nael Sekir, Palestinian, American, Arab, Muslim, good Samaritan in heart, liberal in spirit, married to a Lebanese lady, so I got a little bit of everything. I born and raised in a jail. It's a big jail that's surrounded with guns, tanks, wire, barbed wire. The jailer control the distinct control if you want to eat, if you want to drink good water or not, if you want to study or not. It's a big jail called Gaza. I still have three sisters and one brother live here with their children and grandchildren. They suffer among other Palestinians in Gaza through the ethnic cleanliness that happened. Peter explained all the political issues and what's happening in Gaza, but I look at it in a different way. I look at it as election polling. I look at it as each Israeli leader wants to prove how strong they can be. To get to that, they have to kill Palestinian Arab. We can go back, you can Google something called Deir Yassin in 1948 when Menachem Begin wiped off two small villages so he can prove himself as a good, strong leader. Not too far long away, Shimon Peres, before Shimon Peres, that was Eric Sharon in 1983. Probably many of you heard about what happened in Sabra and Shatila. It was a refugee camp that more than 3,500 innocent civilians got butchered in one night in Lebanon. In 1996, same thing. Sharon Peres wanted to get ready to become a prisoner. So he launched another attack at United Nations shelter in a small village in South Lebanon called Kana. And you can Google that. In 2002, Yehud Barak launched another attack before the election at the refugee camp in Jenin. And lately, before the latest Israeli election, Stevie Leifney, she wanted to prove to her people that she is a strong woman. And of course, she has to kill more and more Palestinians. More than 1,400 people killed in Gaza. More than 5,000 got injured. Thousands of homes demolished. Thousands of ladies. It's hard to say. I would encourage each one of you to watch those pictures. Each picture will tell you more than 1,000 words. Peter mentioned that last week we met Sandy and Craig Corey. They came back from their second trip to Gaza. It was fun to hear from them that more than 10,000 activists, humanitarian, politician, visited Gaza, which is great, right? But nothing happened. Nothing. My brother's home got hit. There is literally no glass. Since then, since last December till now, there is not even one piece of glass to cover the windows and to heat their home. They're using plastic sheets. The drinking water, it's very salty. And in Gaza, we used to eat, because it's in the shore, the fish is one, daily food. Right now, they are waiting to get a frozen fish through the tunnels from Egypt, because they are not allowed to fish their own fish, from their own water, from their own shores. No gas, no electricity. The sewer system does not work. This is what's happening in Gaza every day. The gentleman asked me, it's good to be from Gaza. And I told him, I am proud to be in Gaza, but I'm not sure if it's good to be in Gaza. It's a tragedy. There is big suffering. The siege got to stop. I encourage each one of you to do what you can do to support this event, to support the activists that are going there to march and to help Palestinian people. Thank you very much.
I'm going to introduce our next speaker, Sister Elaine Kelly. Civil is an ecumenical grassroots organization and movement amongst Palestinian Christians. Friends of Civil North America works in the U.S. and Canada to support the mission of Civil through outreach to North American churches, educational conferences, alternative pilgrimages, witness trips, and international gatherings. Please welcome Sister Elaine Kelly.
Hello, everybody. She pretty much gave you a summary of what Civil does. Civil fills a very important role because the churches are very powerful. When they decide to take on an issue, they can get changes made in our governments. What Civil does is try to fill the role that the churches have not traditionally taken on because of their relationship with the Jewish people since the Holocaust. What we do is we educate Christians in North America. We have Civil in other countries as well, but what we do is we put on these fantastic educational conferences all over the country in major cities. We just had big conferences in Washington, D.C. and in Cedar Falls, Iowa. We've had almost 30 of these conferences now. We had one in Portland in 2003. And these conferences are very important because they are not the the choir talking to one another. They draw new people into the movement by inviting area churches and other organizations to co-sponsor the event. So it's not just a Civil event. It's the area churches that take on the event. They promote it in their congregations and get a lot of new people to participate. They come and they hear Palestinian and Israeli peacemakers from Palestine, Israel. They hear experts in many fields, Bible study, theology, history, political currents, all kinds of expert presentations that we provide. And anywhere from 300 to 1,000 people will attend these events. And the other part of our program are our witness trips and international conferences. And I know there's a lot of people here who have been on some of those trips. They're just finishing one today, a witness trip that's been going on for the past 10 days. So people from here can go and travel with Civil throughout the West Bank and Galilee. They meet with Palestinian Christians and Muslims, Israeli peacemakers. They witness the wall, the checkpoints, refugee camps. So when they come back, they are the most, they are very effective speakers in their own communities. And they become the most committed individuals in the movement. People who go and see. That's why it's so important for these young people to go to Gaza, because they'll have it in their gut.
Jenka Soderberg is a journalist. She's a lifelong political activist. She is a very active member of the Oregon campaign to end Israeli apartheid. And she's going to tell you what we can do on the local level to participate in a campaign to boycott and divest interests that profit from the occupation. Jenka.
I think a lot of people know the reasons to engage in a boycott and divestment and sanctions campaign. I just want to go over briefly for people who aren't aware of some of the background of the ethnic cleansing and the apartheid system. There are on the books of Israeli law around 50 laws that are discriminatory against Palestinians, including Palestinian citizens of Israel, which are about 20% of the Israeli population. And then, of course, the more than 5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza and live under martial law. And this isn't a new thing. It didn't begin in 1967, and it actually didn't even begin in 1948. It began before then with a plan of ethnic cleansing by early Zionists. Some of the early Zionists have been quoted as noting that this is a land with a people, not a land without a people, and that those people needed to be expelled and ethnically cleansed in order to create the state for the Jewish people on that land. In 1950, the Law of Return was created, which grants immigration rights to Jews living anywhere in the world, and that was amended in 1970 to include the children and grandchildren of a Jewish person living anywhere in the world. And it also has recently, I'm not sure which year, but fairly recently, been amended to include converts to Judaism as well. So any Jew has the right to return, whereas the Palestinians do not. Palestinians were expelled in 1948, and again in 1967. The absentee property law of 1950 prevents Palestinians who were expelled during those ethnic cleansing operations to return to their own land. It classifies all of their property as absentee property, and they no longer have a right to their property or a right to return to their land. There's a nationality and citizenship law. Anyone who has an Israeli passport doesn't have the nationality Israeli. It's either Jewish as a nationality or Arab as a nationality on the passport. And it also, again, confers automatic citizenship on anyone who returns using the Law of Return. Identity card law, which is similar to the apartheid South Africa law, residents must carry identity cards at all times. Palestinians have different identity cards, obviously, than Jews, and must present them at any time. And population registry law requires all residents of Israel to register their nationality with the population registry. There are many, many other laws on the books like that. These are apartheid laws, and we, at the Oregon Campaign to End Israeli Apartheid, which we just formed as basically a working group from the Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, in order to focus on boycott, divestment, and sanctions. The boycott element, well, all of these laws, and there's a full listing of them on our website, which is endisraeliapartheid.org. And right now, our campaign is focusing on Caterpillar and Motorola. We're also going to be focusing locally on L'Oreal and the Ahava Dead Sea Salt. These companies engage directly with the Israeli military and participate in Israeli apartheid policies. The Motorola company, which not only produces cell phones, also produces military hardware, including bomb fuses. They recently divested from their bomb fuse subcontracting company, thanks, I think, to our campaign. They never said that, but after a strong campaign against them, they divested that part. They still have the communications infrastructure, the Mountain Rose communication system with the Israeli military. They also have the surveillance system used by the Israeli military. It's produced by Motorola. So if you have a Motorola cell phone, if you're thinking about getting a Motorola cell phone, consider not getting a Motorola cell phone and getting rid of the one you have, contacting the company and telling them why. This campaign, the boycott campaign, was effective against apartheid South Africa in changing that company's, that country's laws. And by focusing on the companies that actually do business, we're voting with our dollars, we're affecting change through the companies that actually participate in this unjust system. So we're asking that people boycott Motorola. If you want to boycott other companies that that are engaged in Israeli apartheid practices or that do business in Israel, we have a full listing on that website as well as letters that you can send. Because it's one thing to choose not to buy something because it was produced through apartheid. It's another thing to actually contact the company and say, here's why I'm not purchasing your product. And Caterpillar, for those who aren't aware, makes the D9 armored bulldozer, which was used to kill Rachel Corrie, who is an American activist from Olympia, Washington, as well as many Palestinians who were trying to preserve their land. Olive trees, a million olive trees have been uprooted by D9 bulldozers. This is Palestinians' only source of livelihood in many cases. And the D9 bulldozers are armored and are also used as weapons, not just to destroy homes, to destroy olive trees, but also to actually kill people, including activists like Rachel Corrie, who decided to stand in the way. And Caterpillar is responsible, and these companies can be held responsible by the United Nations Guidelines on the Responsibilities of Multinational Corporations, which state that companies should not engage in or benefit from violations of international human rights or humanitarian law. So we do hope that people will get involved in the Oregon campaign to end Israeli apartheid. We have a website with lots of resources. We also have a petition going against Motorola. We're going to be organizing local actions against the Hava Dead Sea Salts and L'Oreal's Dead Sea Salt subsidiary. For those who don't know, there was a Dead Sea Salt Dead Sea Agreement in the 1920s that Israel has continually violated since that time, which was supposed to provide some of the access to the Dead Sea for both nations. And of course, the Palestinians never got a nation, and they still do not have a nation. And Israel has control over the entire Dead Sea and is using it for their economic advantage and preventing all Palestinians from even going to the Dead Sea, even though it's on the east side of the West Bank. If you know anything about geography, that's the opposite side from where Israel is located. So they have complete control over the Dead Sea as well. And these are some of the companies that we're trying to engage in this boycott of. There's also a divestment campaign. If you're part of a university, a union, a church that has investments, start doing some research into those investments. See if there are some of these companies that are part of the investment strategy that your organization has, and then call on your organization to participate in the divestment. And sanctions is a whole other area, but again, I would focus on contacting your congresspeople, because one of the main sources of funding, as Sammy mentioned, the $3.2 billion in direct aid, there's also close to another $6 billion in indirect aid and loan guarantees that don't have to be paid back. So there's quite a large amount of aid that's given to Israel every year, and if you add it all up, it's about $12 billion, which is the cost to the Israeli military to maintain the occupation of the West Bank and of the Gaza Strip. So that removing that financial benefit that the U.S. gives to Israel could really have a big impact. So thanks to people who did call, David Wu and Earl Blumenauer, as Peter mentioned, it seems to be making a little bit of a difference. It's the U.S. Congress that controls those funds that go to the Israeli government and directly to the military in most cases. So there are three branches to the campaign, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and I hope that everyone can get involved in some way in order to bring about a true victory like what happened in South Africa, where nobody thought that Nelson Mandela, in jail for 27 years, would turn around and become the president of a multicultural South Africa. And who knows what could happen in Palestine if we engage in some of the same strategies that worked in South Africa. Thank you.